Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, February 6th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome two astronomers to the studio. Bob Berman is joined by Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory. Valerie's recovered from her astronomically related injuries, and she's ready to take your calls. If you got a question about Mars, comets, gravity, fast radio bursts, whatever, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I bet you didn't know you could get injured doing astronomy. Well, we'll find out about that. You can email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman here. Your astronomy questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the building for double your fun and double your information. We have one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world, Bob Berman, back again. Bob is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. We also have Dr. Valerie Rapson, chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory, and she earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. She's recovering from terrible astronomy-related injury, and we're just happy she's here and in one piece. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you got a question about the heavens, now's the time. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Bob and Valerie, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Good to be here.
You're hanging in there. You're being very brave, Valerie.
You're making it sound like I'm dying over here. Well, all of our listeners are going to think I'm not going to be back next month now.
You're really pulling through. Well, tell us what happened.
Yeah, so, you know, when you get to know me, I'm not the most graceful person in the world.
I don't know.
So I was walking around last week, and I was looking up at Betelgeuse because, you know, Betelgeuse has been dimming, and I've been checking it out. So I'm walking and staring up at the sky, and, of course, I trip over something on the sidewalk and fall flat on my face.
Ow.
Scraped up my knee, scraped up my hand. So I'm fine. It's healing. It's just, you know, it's an astronomical injury.
Now,
for sure.
Have you, Bob, ever had an astronomical related injury?
Ever? Well, I'm clumsy too, so I must have, but I think I've suppressed them all.
Yeah, you have a swimming pool. So you ever fall in the pool while you're looking at the heavens?
Not yet.
Well, that's good. But the whole Betelgeuse thing is very interesting now, Bob. And last time you were on, I think Valerie must have been recovering and was not here last time you were on. You were saying, well, it's dimming, but it's not that big of a deal. You're changing your tune.
Well, you know why? I have changed my tune. And the reason is that back then the media was trying to tie that into the fact that it could become a supernova, which it could, but it could happen tonight or it could happen in 100,000 years. We'd love it to happen tonight because to see a naked eye supernova, the last one was 1604, unless you count 1987 when one went off in the next galaxy. And I actually brought a group of people down to Panama near the equator to see it because it couldn't be seen from this far north. But, except for them, a naked eye supernova, of course we want it to blow up tonight. But it's not likely. So I didn't want people to get excited about that, so I poo-pooed it. But you know what? Now that Betelgeuse, and yes, you can say Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse is slightly preferred.
I prefer Betelgeuse.
It's not wrong to say it. Valerie and I will pronounce it differently. That's okay.
Okay.
But here's the thing. It's now continued to fade to where it only matches the other shoulder of Orion, the star Bellatrix, which is fairly dim, medium bright star, magnitude 1.6, for those who know what that means. In other words, Orion does not have two bright stars in it these nights anymore. It only has one bright star, and the rest are all medium bright stars, and that so changes its look that it's a little traumatic. It's a little weird. It's not a little thing anymore. No.
Well, Valerie, what is it about the dimming and the continued dimming that excites astronomers?
Right. Well, when you see a star that's a supergiant start to dim, it usually means it's changing size and changing temperature. So they think that Betelgeuse has changed, probably cooled off about 100 degrees Kelvin or so, and it's actually getting larger. Usually the stars get a little bit smaller when they get fainter like this, but this one might actually be growing in size.
You say might. How would you confirm such a thing at such a great distance?
Right. Well, this one, I mean, is fairly close, so we can kind of get a sense of what we think is happening based on its age. age and spectroscopic measurements and motions of stellar material actually on the surface. But we're trying to see if the star is actually growing to the point where it's going to let go of some of the material, and maybe that's why it's dimming, is that it actually released some of that material that's now blocking the star's light, or if it's actually the star just changing.
Now, does that mean, Bob, if it releases a percentage of its mass, that in fact it needn't become a supernova, or is this a foregone conclusion?
No, it'll become a supernova because it's somewhere between 10 and 20 times the mass of the sun, of our sun. And even if it releases a bunch of material, it's not going to release enough to alter its unfortunate fate. But it is changing enough so that we've actually been monitoring it. At my observatory in Willow, we've been watching it spectroscopically to see if there's any. We know the brightness is dimmer, but are there spectroscopic changes? Because Betelgeuse shows this beautiful and unusual spectrum with dark bands of titanium oxide, bands that you normally usually see dark lines called Fraunhofer lines in the spectrum of a star. But a very cool star like Betelgeuse, and I don't mean cool in the hip sense,
right?
You know, in the temperature sense.
It really hasn't been hip in about 70 years, to say that.
It's so cool that it even has molecules, whole molecules on the surface, like titanium dioxide and water. And you can see these in the spectrum. So I've been watching it to see if that's changing, to let us know if firsthand the star inherently. And it would have to change grossly for me to see it, because I don't have a spectrograph that's stretching out its spectrum to be 20 feet long.
Right.
So it's just up to Bob to look at it and go, duh, yeah, it looks the same as a month ago.
Right.
So I don't want to, you know, pretend toward like...
Have you seen any changes?
No.
No.
But it's pretty. And the colors are very intense. And usually in astronomy, when we do observing, we don't get saturated colors, because all the stars, as probably people remember, are pastels. You know, when we say it's a blue star, it's really blue-white. When we say it's a red supergiant, it's really yellow-orange. It's just barely, the colors are barely there. Not through a spectroscope. There, the colors are like rainbow colors. So we all get a kick out of seeing that.
Have you been doing any observation of this, Valerie, at Dudley Observatory?
We haven't, no. We do have some students over at Siena College who are hoping to use their new observatory there to do some monitoring of the brightness as a small project. But it's been so cloudy here, we really haven't had much of a chance to get out and see it, you know. The one night it's clear, I'm up there staring at it and I fall over. So, you know.
There you go. Now, if and when, and it will eventually go supernova, how long will it be in the sky that we'll be able to see if we're around?
A year, typically.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And that's it? And then it goes away?
Yeah, but it starts out bright. It's the brightest for a month or so.
Will we see it in daylight?
Yeah, because this is only 640 light years away. The supernovae that we had in 1572 and 1604 and in 1054, they were all thousands of light years away, and yet they were bright enough to cast shadows.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's only 640 light years away. A little bit of doubt, by the way. Some might say closer to 600, some might say closer to 700, but that's the ballpark. That's bright enough so that it will be brilliant. And we figure that Venus is the cutoff for seeing it by day, because when Venus is at its brightest, which it will be in March and April, then you can see it by day. We all have, not you, but we have. Have you seen it by day, Valerie?
I have.
Well, there you go.
Now, the you say it's close, 640 light years or whatever, and it'll be seen in the day, most likely.
Mm-hmm.
Are we in any danger? Gamma radiation or anything else?
No, we're good. We're good.
It's far enough away.
Yep. Most of the radiation, it'll just perpetuate out into space. And by the time it arrived at our solar system, it'd be so minimal that we won't feel anything. We won't notice it, but we will see it.
The slight radiation could change evolution a little bit. Could give us back our, cats that have more than four toes.
Yeah.
Those cats, you see them, they catch mice better, I think, from that.
Well, if they caught mice better, wouldn't evolution say that they would all have more toes?
Right. And I'm looking forward to us getting our tails back because...
All right. You know what? Let's grab...
No. This is not an embarrassing thing. Don't you, when you want to hold a flashlight and use a screwdriver and a plier, don't you miss the tail?
Right. I wish there was an impeachment hearing. Hey, let's take a call. 800-348-2551. Ken in Warwick County. Ken, you're on.
Oh, man.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Anyway, my question has to do with the length of the days. So right now our days are getting longer because our sunsets are later, but also our sunrises are earlier. Back in the fall, obviously, it was the opposite, where the sunsets were getting earlier. However, it's never made sense to me that the earliest sunset of the year is not the actual shortest day, that they're actually off by a week or two.
Right.
And if our guests could explain why it is that the earliest sunset always comes like a week or two before the actual
shortest day. I
got to tell
you, Ken, Bob Berman is exceptionally well-practiced with this answer. So go ahead. He does it on almost every show.
Though I wish, because the question keeps coming up, and it's a very reasonable question, and I wish we had TV for here. There is a TV camera that's kind of sneakily watching
yes,
us.
Yes, if you're watching on our website, WAMC.org.
But I don't have a chalkboard, so I can't do it.
It does look like a surveillance camera at a 7-Eleven, just saying.
But what we want is the analemma, and if you're looking at the TV, it looks like this. It looks like the number 8. And what the analemma is, they used to have analemma on old-fashioned globes of the Earth. It'd be like a figure 8.
Yeah.
They used to put it somewhere inauspicious, so it wouldn't block land, like out in the Pacific somewhere.
Yeah.
But what that means is, the short answer to your question is, yes, the longest night and shortest day is December 21st. So why, you're asking, is that darkest afternoon or earliest sunset on December 7th? Why is it 2 weeks different? Why don't they match? Why don't we get the darkest afternoon the same day we get the darkest day or the longest night? Why don't they match? And the answer has to do with the physical reality is one thing, but how it matches to our clocks and calendars is another, because the calendars use a absolute standard distance from day to day and an absolute standard length of each day, and they never vary throughout the year. But the sun, because that's what we're talking about, when the sun sets, the sun changes its position in the sky because we change our orbit. Kepler told us by his second law that because we have an elliptical, not round orbit, we speed up and we slow down. And because of that, it looks like the sun is speeding up and slowing down.
Right.
So if we mark where the sun is today, if we could see the background stars, which we could if there was a total eclipse going on, but you can't usually, and then see where the sun is tomorrow against the background stars, that interval is normally 2 sun widths from day to day against the background stars. But it varies because our Earth, is varying our speed around it. And because the sun changes where it should be from the average, it means that the average time when it's going to set is not valid. Our clocks and our calendars use the average time, but the real sun may be ahead of or behind the average time. So that's the real reason behind it. And if you look up analemma in the sky, that figure 8, that's a plot for where the sun is on every day of the year relative to our clocks. So we'd say at 12 noon, where is the sun? And some days it's further advanced to the right or to the west. Some days it lags behind. In the summer it's higher, in the winter it's lower. It all forms a big figure 8. And the earliest sunset will not be the date that the sun hits the horizon, but when the analemma first touches the horizon will mark our earliest sunset.
All right, we'll take a break here.
Darkest afternoon.
Bob Berman is here. Dr. Valerie Rapson. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Astronomy Today. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's call-in talk show. Ray Graff here. Number is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today, and we have the dynamic duo of astronomy, Valerie Rapson from the Dudley Observatory and author and astronomer Bob Berman here. Hey, Bob, are you heading out anywhere in the old special interest tours?
Yes, going to our yearly Alaska trip, our secret place in central Alaska, where the skies tend to be clear, and where there's an aurora 2 out of 3 nights, so that people who love the Northern Lights or who have never seen one want to see them, we take them there every year.
Exciting. And how do you find out about that?
And we're going to go there next month and find out dates and everything, special interest tours.
All right. Very good. And now I understand, Valerie, that you are now an after dinner speaker and you did a great presentation about sending people to Mars the other night.
Yeah, I guess so. So I was at the Troy Library last night doing a talk about all of our plans going back to the moon as well as heading back to Mars and all the things that we have to think about, not only the engineering and rocketry and all that stuff that we need, but also the human aspect of what do we have to do to make sure that they can mentally and physically handle the trip and the food and the facilities that they're going to need once they get there.
Now, Bob and I have talked about this many times over the years, and Bob has always been a little skeptical of sending people to Mars, not least of which for the radiation factor.
Mm-hmm.
But also you bring up a great point about food. A lot of supplies will have to be brought.
Yeah.
We've seen the movie The Martian or mm-hmm. I've seen parts of it. I couldn't stand the whole thing. But, you know, he grew his own food.
Right.
And I suppose that's part of the plan, too.
Yeah, they've done some studies with CubeSats, those little satellites that orbit the Earth, where they've put simulated Martian soil inside. And
yeah.
They can actually grow potatoes and things like that as long as you provide the water and the fertilizer, which is key. And neither of those are on Mars. So we have to bring everything we need and attempt to grow our own food.
Seems like an enormous undertaking.
It really is.
Bob, you're still skeptical? You know, the president during the State of the Union said man and woman on the moon by 2024, and I think he said Mars by the end of the decade.
I'm not going to be able to top President Donald Trump with that, so we'll leave the last word with him because
wow.
He would know best.
This email, are you being sarcastic? This email came in from Harleen. Bob, can you explain why you believe in panpsychism?
In what?
I don't know. It's panpsychism.
Panspermia?
Am I saying it wrong?
I do believe in panpsychism. Is a word I've never seen before.
Okay, well, then you can't believe in it.
No, right. I don't know what that means. Unless psyche, the pan, is everywhere. Everybody is psychic.
The universe is alive. Maybe I think that's what biocentrism perhaps is.
Google tells me it's about consciousness. So the doctrine or belief that everything, however small, has an element of individual consciousness.
Interesting.
That's what it means.
You know, it's funny. I brought up biocentrism. The first thing Bob did was look at the clock because it's a long conversation.
Well, the two biocentrism, there's one written, but it's not out yet. The biocentrism books are now in languages all over the world. They're selling well, so people are interested in that. And one of the principles is that that biology is central, not secondary, in the universe. Now, it kind of started with Werner Heisenberg. We're talking about a whole century ago, one of the great genius founders of quantum mechanics. And these guys were finding that as you do experiments, you get different results depending upon who's watching, whether you're watching, and how you're measuring things.
Yeah.
They were not early hippie types. To them, this was astonishing. It was they came to the conclusion kind of reluctantly that somehow the act of observing or consciousness is central to nature. In other words, we're not just here as secondarily, even though if you ask the average person, is that green color on that poster, would that still be there if no one was in the room? And most people say, yeah, of course it'll be there. We could all leave. It's there. It's inherently there. And, you know, it takes a physicist, or in this case maybe a physiologist, to tell you, no, our brains create the colors. Those are just magnetic and electrical impulses.
Yeah,
that's what light is. There are no colors inherently unless we create it. So you keep going with other areas, and you see that perhaps consciousness is central to everything in the universe.
But my brain did not create the meatloaf that's left over in my fridge, and it's still going to be there when I get back.
And it will still be good?
Delicious. Okay. This one is from Joel in Blooming Grove. What is the biggest mystery in the universe besides the universe itself?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm sure everyone will have their own biggest mystery, but I think all of this stuff that we can't see, the dark matter and the dark energy, has to be the biggest mystery because it makes up 96% of the universe, a good majority of the universe. We have no idea what it actually is, but it seems to be affecting our galaxies and our stars and us
seems
every day.
Seems to be. Now, are we missing something? Is it really there?
I mean, we could be. There's so much evidence, though, that says that there has to be some stuff, some physical whatever out there affecting us. There's a small chance that it could just be some math that needs to be tweaked, but... You know, some really smart people have been working on this, and it really looks like there's got to be some physical matter that makes up dark matter and some energy in the field that makes up dark energy.
Okay. Bob, you're in on this?
Yeah. I would say, what's the biggest mystery in the universe? I might vote for consciousness. I might get back to that. But since we don't want to open up that Pandora
box. No, it's only a half hour left. So.
Then let's just say this. The odd thing about this universe that we find ourselves in is that we seem to be answering... I don't want to call them the smaller questions, but the more obvious questions very well. We know the sun has 333,000 times the mass of Earth. Mm-hmm. We know that the moon turns on its axis in 27.32166 days. That's not going to change, not by a second, not even 100 years from now. So we have a lot of things down with science really well. But basic questions. How big is the universe? What is it fully made of, as Valerie was just saying, with it seeming dark energy and dark matter being the primary components, and yet we don't know what they are. How big is it? And these basic, you'd think these would be the foundational questions.
Right.
We don't know. Hmm. So it's sort of the opposite of the way kids start learning things when they're little, where you learn the basics first and then you get more and more details. We know a lot of the details and we don't know the basics.
Mm-hmm. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Etc. Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson and also astronomer Bob Berman. Let's go back to the phones. TJ in Kronkson, you're on.
Hi. Listen, this is interesting because the two things I wanted to bring up fall right into what we were speaking about. One, about a year ago, there was a report that astrophysicists had determined that there were more than 2 trillion more galaxies than the billions and billions, as Carl Sagan would always be famous for saying. Yeah. That we already knew about, yet it really didn't get, and these were from some pretty reputable sources, but it didn't get the exposure or I think importance that it should have. The other thing is I can tell you, all there is consciousness.
Okay.
And that's the solution. There is only one consciousness.
Whose is it?
Everything within that consciousness. Well, that consciousness is what most of us call God or nature or the universe.
Yeah.
But in other words, consciousness doesn't develop from an individual organism. All there is consciousness.
Now, how do you know this, TJ? I'm not saying you're wrong, but how do you know it?
Well, I always kept my eye on astrophysics and physics, but also I studied philosophy and metaphysics. And it is the solution to everything, is that all there is one consciousness.
Okay.
And actually, if you believe that, there also is the potential for an afterlife. If you don't believe there is only one consciousness, then there is no afterlife.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that's another show. Very good.
And I'm being...
I can touch on the galaxy side of that.
All right,
real
so go
quick.
Ahead with the galaxies.
Yeah, I mean, so we're constantly looking for new galaxies and attempting to determine exactly how many there are. And we have not observed them all, right? Even if there's only a billion out there, we can't see them all. So we estimate. We take a picture of the sky and say, okay, in that amount of space, I see 1,000 galaxies, you know, multiply by how many of those pictures would fill the whole night sky, and you get your approximation of galaxies. And they've definitely upped that a little bit. Because our telescopes get better, the farther back in time we see, the more galaxies appear in our images. So it looks like the total number of galaxies that are there has definitely increased.
Now, as I understand it, and I understand very little, let's put that right out there. But at 13.8 billion light years or whatever, everything redshifts out of the visible light, right?
Mm-hmm. And
isn't there a limit of what you will see if you're at that line or whatever, however many light years that is? If you reach that line with technology and whatever, and you can see to the end of that, we don't really know if there's anything beyond there, right?
Well, exactly right. So when Valerie was saying how many galaxies and explaining how we detect them, the bigger underlying question is how many galaxies in what? In the universe? But then you'd say in which universe? There are two. There's the visible universe. That's what you were just saying, Ray, mm-hmm. out to that distance of about 13 billion light years. Those are the things we can ever hope to observe, because beyond that, the light will never get here. Or are you talking about how many galaxies in the meta-universe, the universe beyond that? And we didn't know how big that was until a recent hint in 2013, when Shirley Ho and others analyzed 900,000 galaxies, the biggest ever galaxy survey, that showed us for the first time what may lie beyond the edge of the observable universe. And their results, we've talked about this before, showing that space is a flat topography right to the visible boundary, means that stuff keeps going on and on abundantly. One theory is that there is 300 trillion, that's the figure, 300 trillion times more galaxies beyond that point that we can see than the part that we can see.
And what's beyond that?
And the other is that it could be infinite, because, in fact, Shirley Ho told me after the data was published that their data permits an infinite universe. You can never prove infinity, but their data permits an infinite universe, in which case the answer to the question that the caller brought up is that the galaxies go on and on without end.
What do you make of that, Valerie?
I mean, it sounds cool, but it's hard for me to believe things that I can't see and can't detect. So sure, you know, mathematically, it might be true, might be possible, but I'm a person who likes to see the picture, and,
yeah.
you know, actually be able to have a little bit of hardcore proof that that's the way it is. But
now,
regardless, there's so much stuff out there.
What if Professor Ho was wrong in the math? And in fact, it is not a flat topology. Now, someone postulated in the last 6 months that in fact, it may be ring-shaped, and there may be some mathematical evidence to suggest that it is not flat. Then you could theoretically be able to count them all, right?
Oh, then you can get really crazy. In that case, the overall universe may be smaller than the visible universe.
Right.
And you'd have to go, what?
What?
But back in I just ran this in Astronomy Magazine. In fact, back in the 90s, when I was with Discover Magazine, one of my columns, I pointed out that if the universe is finite in extent.
You could see yourself, the back of your head.
And unbounded.
Yeah.
Exactly, Ray.
Yeah.
This is why when my wife listens to these shows later on, she says, Ray is just so smart.
Oh.
See, you're the back of your head.
Bottle.
Yeah, she says that almost every time after
okay.
the show.
All right.
So you're saying it exactly right. See the back of your head. In other words, some galaxy that's nearby, we could see the backside of that galaxy after its light had circled around the circumference of the entire universe. We'd probably not recognize it as the same galaxy because its light would be so old that we'd be seeing this galaxy at an earlier stage of its evolution, and it would be hard to tell it was the same one.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's the truth,
yeah.
and there are duplicates out there, a bunch of duplicates, then the actual overall universe could be smaller than the visible universe, not larger.
Tell me true, Val. Exactly. How much do you regret being here?
No, I never regret being
really?
Here.
Really? Okay.
I like, sometimes I just like to sit and listen.
All right, well, let's jump back on the phones here. Michael in Albany. Michael, you're on.
Last night, about 10 o'clock, I witnessed a ring around the moon.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably atmospheric.
Sure is.
But I've never seen anything like that before and wondered what causes it.
We got bad weather today, man.
I have two questions for you. One, was it truly a ring, meaning did it have a dark space, an empty space between the moon and the ring, or did the brightness start at the moon so it was more like a disk?
No, it was... It was quite a ways away.
Okay. Then what you saw was the 22-degree halo. Next time you see it, hold out your arm at arm's length all the way out. Spread your fingers, your pinky and your thumb, so they're as wide apart as possible. And if you put the thumb on the moon, the pinky will show you exactly the position of the ring, because they're always the same size, 22 degrees. And if there's any color, usually there isn't, it's pale. But if there's any color, red will be on the inside.
Well, let me tell you what my sort of folk wisdom from my grandmother and my father, and we used to see them all the time when I was a kid. They say, okay, you see that ring around the moon, hey, you're probably going to have a day off from school tomorrow because it's going to snow.
And they're right, because normally when a weather front comes through, it starts with the higher stuff coming in first, and those are ice crystal clouds, and those halos are caused by six-sided ice crystals that the moonlight is refracting from. That's why you get that 22-degree separation reliably.
Yeah, unfortunately, though, we only missed school once or twice of all those times. But you did get bad weather today, Michael, so what you're seeing is ice crystals up there. We'll take a break. Bob Berman is our guest. Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's astronomy and other things today. 800-348-2551. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It's 800-348-2551. Having fun talking about astronomy today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. This email came in from Paul in the Berkshires. And it's a little longer than we like, Paul, but I'm going to read it anyway. Paul writes, "It seems like a lot of our theories of the universe expansion rest on measures of distance that we infer from the brightness of objects called standard candles. It would seem that if we're wrong about their distances or how standard they are, then a lot of the general consensus about dark energy could be wrong, too. Would a more sensitive telescope from a place further away give us a more accurate confirmation of standard candles' distance using parallax, or do you think nearby instruments like the Gaia are sufficient?" Fine question, Paul in the Berkshires.
That is a good question. So he's exactly right. You know, this idea of measuring these supernova to try and understand the distances to galaxies is the way we've done it for a long time. And astronomers are starting to see that maybe it's not exactly right in a sense that maybe they're not as much of a standard candle as we thought. But we don't really have another way of doing it. It's not possible to build a large enough telescope to do parallax of other galaxies. They're just much too far away. I mean, Gaia's doing great things. That's a telescope that's looking at the parallax or the shift of stars in the sky. And we can go much further in our own galaxy than ever before, but we're definitely not going to be able to check out parallaxes of other galaxies. So I think our understanding has to stem from, are these supernovas actually truly good standard candles? And if not, how do we adjust our mathematics and our theories to correct for that?
We're starting to split hairs a little bit because we're after better accuracy. So as Valerie pointed out, supernovae, especially a certain type, we call them type 1A, seem to all reach the same maximum brightness. Mm-hmm. And since it turns out, yes, there's refinements in that, but since that's roughly true, yeah, if we see a type 1A supernova in a galaxy that's a certain distance relative to a different one, they appear different brightnesses. Since light falls off inversely with the square of distance, we can calculate how far the galaxy would be from that. But it's not all we use. We use Cepheid variables, mm-hmm, which are extremely bright stars for the closer galaxies. They can be seen individually in Andromeda and M33 and a number of close-up galaxies. And then there's something else. As galaxies are farther away, they look smaller, don't they? You know, something farther away, the spirals actually have a smaller size to them. Mm-hmm. Well, there are, but then galaxies have certain characteristics like how fast they're rotating, depending upon their mass, that also called the Tully-Fisher relationship, that also gives clues to how big they actually must be. And then we compare that with how big they appear. So all I'm saying is that there are multiple independent ways of gauging distance, of which the type 1A supernovae is one of them. And what we've come up with, the latest for the Hubble constant, is that it seems to be that the universe is expanding at a speed of 14 miles per second for each million light years farther away it is. Usually it's expressed as in terms of megaparsecs, and we use kilometers per second on miles, but I'm just for the people who are comfortable with miles and million light years rather than megaparsecs, that's the figure. And it's pretty good. I mean, you'll see a refinement every few years in the Astrophysical Journal, and they'll say, no, it's not 14, it's 13.1. But we're there. We've pretty much gotten it.
Interesting side fact. The Tully-Fisher relationship was one of my favorite Philadelphia soul bands from the 70s. They're on Soul Train all the time.
That's
great. It was tremendous. David in Poughkeepsie. David, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Ray, you sort of asked a bit of my question earlier, but I'll ask it anyway.
Sure.
I've been reading about the James Webb telescope that they're building and planning on sending up, and about how far back it's going to be able to see. And I I guess it's going to be able to see, like, just after first stars started forming or so. And
right.
I'm wondering what the limit of what we will ever be able to see is, and what is the thing that limits it?
Right. Well, there's definitely a limit that's kind of imposed by the universe itself. So you might have heard of this thing called the cosmic microwave background that microwave-style telescopes can observe. And that's light when it existed in the very beginning of the universe, 380,000 years after we think the Big Bang that created the universe happened. And light was not continually in existence in the way that we perceive it now up until that point. So our telescopes can theoretically look as far back as that moment, but we can never see beyond that. We'll never be able to see the very beginning of the universe with a standard telescope, maybe with gravitational waves or some other technique, but not with James Webb or any standard telescope.
I'm so glad Valerie said that. I almost forgot to mention that after the last show, when I mentioned that the universe first got transparent, this is the part that Valerie was talking about, when the cosmic microwave background emanated from the time when things could travel through space because it was transparent. And I said it was 789,000 years after the Big Bang. When I got home and I played the tape that evening over dinner
you
from my wife.
You played the tape of this?
Of the show, yeah. My wife likes to hear. She's
what
a school teacher. She messes
punishment.
It every day. Right. And I also sent it to my friend who's an observatory director. And I said, did I say 789,000? That's wrong. It's 389,000.
Yeah. We all
and,
make mistakes.
And then when my friend listened to it, I told him, I said, I'm going to send you a tape. You can see if you can find out what I said wrong and that, during that hour. And he called me back. He said, really? You said 789,000. It should have been 389,000. I said, right. Okay, next time I'm on, I'm going to do a mea culpa. But Valerie beat me to it. She just said 300,000, so...
Terrific.
There it is.
Does that have anything to do with David's question?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, because that's as far back as you can look.
Oh, I see.
Right.
Oh,
so
I
the
see.
Light,
I
yeah,
understand.
The
yes.
light was constantly being absorbed and re-emitted up until that point. That's when, as Bob said, the universe becomes transparent, the light can travel through,
and that's
and
the
you can
oldest. So that's the oldest.
Yeah.
When he's talking about what's older, there's nothing older.
All right, David, hey, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And Rosie in Maine. Where are you in Maine, Rosie?
Hey, everybody. I'm calling from Bath, Maine.
So great. I love Maine.
Yeah.
I love Maine. So great to hear from you. Go ahead.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. Ever since, 2015, when they discovered the gravity waves, I've been a big LIGO enthusiast, and I'd be curious to hear what everybody thinks, how we could apply that technology or how we could apply that discovery to technology and, any kind of applications to what we've discovered since then.
Well, I think that's kind of what we're working towards. I mean, historically, we make a lot of discoveries in science and in astronomy that, are purely astronomical at the moment they're discovered, but then eventually kind of trickle down into everyday technology. And I'm hoping that gravitational waves will be one of them. We don't really have a practical use, per se, for understanding them or a way to utilize them. But, someday that might be possible.
Come with us on our trips to Chile every year. We visit LIGO every year.
Really?
Yeah, So
it's a long way from Maine, I'll tell you that.
Special interest tours from Maine. Get right from Maine. Anyway, you want to get away from Maine. There's not enough deciduous trees there.
Oh, Maine is one of the most beautiful places in the world,
too,
man.
Too few deciduous trees.
All right, Rosie, do you disagree?
This time of year, absolutely.
All right.
Wait in line at the lobster shack. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right,
so
thanks, everybody.
Thanks so much for calling. We'll see you this summer. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And over on line 7 is Mark in Pittsfield. Mark.
Yes, hello. Wonderful. I heard you say the Fraunhofer lines again, which is a great reference. I also wanted to mention that one of the greatest things in the universe would be black holes, and my alma mater, UMass, discovered black holes and had a great picture of a black hole for the first time. I think you might have mentioned it before, but I think that's just a great discovery.
We've mentioned that, and Bob and I have often discussed the fact that you're not really taking a picture of the black hole, though.
Right, and that famous one that was released about a year ago was not really, I mean, it was advertised, the captions all said it was a photo of a black hole, but it was actually the place where background radio waves had been disturbed so that there was a space, but that black gap that looked like a donut, the photograph, and that black gap was actually 100 times bigger than the actual black hole would have been. So it wasn't a real photo of a black hole.
You're seeing the effect of the black hole, though.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yes, well said.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And now to John in Cobleskill. John.
Hey, hello. Thanks for having me on the air.
You bet.
I actually have a very similar question to the one that the gentleman just asked about black holes. My question is, how does this actually give evidence that you can see that this is the effect from a black hole? How can you prove that it's not from something else?
Can I answer that? Because my favorite black hole
is
out.
I was not going to answer it, so go ahead.
And then Valerie, who knows this stuff inside and outside.
Oh, no, go for it.
Okay, well, in Cygnus the Swan, which is still out, it's low in the west these nights when night falls, there is a star in the, if you know Cygnus, it's got a long neck and it's got only one star in the neck, and that's the star Eta Cygni. Half a degree from it, and it's a visible star to the naked eye, half a degree to the east-northeast, there is a star that you can only see with binoculars. It's got the catchy name of HDE226868.
Oh, yeah.
This star whirls around, is hurled around something in just under a week, makes circles. But this star has a spectral type B, I believe, that shows that it's about 12 times heavier than our sun. Now, what could make a star this heavy be thrown like a sumo wrestler, thrown around in a circle once a week? We do the calculations, and it would have to be a very massive object. But there's nothing there. Massive stars are very luminous stars. There's nothing there even with the Keck telescope. There's nothing there. Mm-hmm. Secondly, from this spot comes a stream of X-rays. It's the most intense X-rays in that whole quadrant of the sky. And we're still not finished. The X-rays flicker very rapidly. Now, to flicker coherently and rapidly means the object has to be tiny. So if you put together all the facts.
Why?
Because light or gravity would be out of phase otherwise. Let's say the sun tried to vary in light. The sun is so big at 865,000 miles in diameter that light actually takes a few seconds to cross from one side of the sun to the other. So let's say the sun tried to vary its light output. Well, one part of the sun dimming as that light headed toward us would be meeting another part of the sun that wasn't dimming at that moment.
Phase cancellation.
Exactly. The phase, they'd be out of phase. So for the sun to coherently and crisply get dimmer and brighter and dimmer and brighter, it would have to have a certain size to it. I mean, and for this coherency, it has to be a tiny size. So high mass, X-rays, all of which theory tells us is exactly what should happen if material is spiraling in to the accretion disk within the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole. And so a black hole explains it. So we call this whole thing, we don't call this star HDE226868 anymore most of the time. We call that whole part of the sky Cygnus X1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
X1, because it's the strongest source of X-rays in the entire part of the sky, in all of Cygnus. So to answer the caller's question, how do we know? That's how we know, and it's pretty darn sure.
Right, right. And if you take everything Bob just said and scale it up to galaxy scales, that's how we know that these black holes are at the center of galaxies. We watch these stars whip around the center, which appears to have an incredible amount of mass and no light other than those individual stars. So,
all right. Thank you for the call, John. The number is 800-348-2551. And now to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Ray. One of your previous callers, mentioned something and the law of unintended consequences when you, in astronomy, and I was trained in astronomy, you find things that you didn't expect to find, and they can be applied to technology.
Yeah.
And it leads right into my question and for, about the Dudley Observatory. I have to always bring the Dudley up.
Yeah,
sure.
I worked there. I worked there from 1970 to 1974.
Great.
And Dr. Mayo Greenberg was doing space dust, as Dudley was famous for, because they didn't know how much dust was on the moon. And Werner von Braun, they had a clean room and all that. And they started experimenting with microwave and long radio wave and using styrofoam particles to represent microparticles. And all of a sudden, over 1973 to 74, the entire operation became classified and disappeared to an Air Force base down in Washington, D.C. And a few years later, the stealth aircraft shows up. Now, I don't have any proof because it's classified, but I think that Dudley was involved with that through their good offices as studying the space dust.
Well, yeah, you work over there. What's your security clearance?
I mean, yeah, none. No security clearance.
You know anything about that?
Personally, I don't know anything about those details. You know, I guess my security clearance isn't high enough to know all of that. But I mean, it definitely, I know that the Dudley Observatory did a lot of great work, especially during the space race era. And, you know, we see a lot of that technology from that time.
I got to tell you, Mark, you never cease to amaze me, sir. Thank you for the call. And now we jump over to Alec in Albany. Alec.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me on. And I was hearing you talk about like the sentient universe, and I'd love to have you try and poke any holes you see in an idea I've had. I've heard that the universe may have been completely water at one point, as it expanded and there was fusion, and there may have been a lot of water, and it may have been all one liquid sphere. And what if at that point life evolved way early and realized it was expanding, realized like all kinds of things, and made a biological program? And here's my reasoning, because iron is the top of the nuclear energy curve. All light atoms, when they fuse, are trying to become heavier to become like iron. All heavy ones, when they fission, are going back to iron. And iron has this unique self-organizing principle, where if you have two magnets on a table and you take one of them and you move it closer slowly, eventually the one you're not touching is going to reorient and attract without attract to the one you have. So what if the purpose of life is to evolve to where we can first get to world peace and all and environmental sameness and all that, and then evolve to where we can use the suns as forges and create more iron to increase the net magnetism of the universe and prevent heat death.
Wow, that's your own theory, is it? I've not heard that one. Anybody want to jump in?
Yeah, I'll jump in. Again, with Astronomy Magazine, the last 25 years, and Discover before that, I get a lot of letters from readers and theories. I have never heard one that tied together world peace with iron and magnetism
and
liquid and everything being liquid. But I tell you, the liquid part of it would be far-fetched, just because you have to know liquids only form under pressure. Like, you can't have water as a liquid unless you have something pushing on it.
Huh.
And so in space, you couldn't have a liquid universe. You couldn't have liquid. Oh. You can't have a liquid planet. You can't have liquid water on the surface of anything unless you have something supplying pressure. On Earth, it's our atmosphere that does the job. And on Enceladus and Europa, it's probably ice pressing down that does the job. So you're not going to have a liquid universe.
Well, interesting side note, Liquid Universe was my favorite psychedelic band.
Another
right, one. That's it now. We're done. Thank you both for being here. Support comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear featuring new styles for 2020, including sunglasses featured in Ford versus Ferrari movie with Matt Damon. 518-459-2638. At Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Well, thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here, and thank you for listening. Great calls. Very interesting calls. The liquid universe, I'm on this now with the iron and everything else. Thank you for that one. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, and phones answered by Jim Harrison. Thanks to our co-producers, Jim Lavoulis and Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Tom Krause of Krause's Homemade Candy and Joe Serrata of Uncle Sam's All-American Chocolate Factory join us with their sweet treats for Valentine's Day. Oh, boy, that'll be a good one. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.